All right. Well, good afternoon and welcome. Good to be here. I'm honored to come this afternoon and share with you a little bit of my story and just the title, Seeing God at Work in Urban Church Planting. And it's a subject that excites me. I have a passion for the city. I love the city. I am city. That's, you know, all I know, and I have a passion for it, and I'm excited to be here. And I have to say up front, I am going to probably major on the urban, because you know what? I have never planted a church. As the first picture is going to show you very clearly, that's the beginning, 1932, and I haven't moved since. Now, I was not there then, obviously, but I still park in that same parking lot every Sunday morning. And that's where we began almost 100 years ago. The Mennonites, this was our leg that we moved over to Fairview, the south side. And so I'm going to talk some about that, but a lot about urban and the experience of the urban life that I've experienced. And Lauren sold me on it. I think he's sitting out there somewhere. He's supposed to be over there. He sold me on it when he talked about the 20 years. Yeah, we're looking for somebody 20 years. And then I got into the meat of it a little more. I'm like, oh, church planting. Well, but so I'm excited to do it. And I thought I could be most effective to simply tell you a story. And I'm going to tell a story. And as I'll get into, I say, I stand on the shoulder of greatness. And we need that again. Because what I'm doing, I'm carrying on something. And I love what I do. I love what I do. But I was not that pioneer. But we need more pioneers. And that's kind of what this is all about. I don't view myself necessarily as the apostle in Ephesians 4, the sent one. But I probably tend to be more on the teacher, administrator side, pastor side. And I stand on shoulders of greatness. But I love what I do. I feel so blessed. It is such a cool thing I get to do every day. And I love to do it. I love ministering to hurting people. Most of the time, I love living. You know, that's the thing about urban, man. You are on top of each other. I like to put these two pictures up for a couple reasons. Because it's just Reading, okay? We live on top of each other. And I lived in one of those houses for the first 10 years of my marriage. I had four children in that house. And I owned the bottom one then. I thought I'd be a real estate guy like my dad, and I lost so much money renting, I got out. But I lost thousands of people trying to be nice. But I lived in the upper house, and I listened as they negotiated whether I could buy the lower house. So that just gives you a picture of urban living. I made an offer, and I just listened to them negotiate, the realtor and the guy, my offer. And okay, yeah, I knew they were going to take my offer before they came over. And that's part of urban living. You live on top of each other. You hear everything. You can play music for the next door neighbor. So I say most of the time I like it. But as you know, cities are people. People are problems. And we know that. And cities are theaters of conflict. But it's where God puts his hands in the mud. I like that. It's not original with me, but it's got where God puts his hands in the mud. And I say, in the city, you simply get more bang for your buck because there's more people. And you can be a witness anywhere. I want you to know you don't have to move to the city. Please don't hear that. But I didn't put the word urban in here. He did. And so I'm going to focus on that today. We know our Anabaptist culture has not typically prioritized the cities. Okay, we haven't. And I've heard sermons in the past, Sodom and Gomorrah, how terrible things the city is, and it'll do to your family. And we somewhat have grown up with that mentality. And I'm glad it is changing. You know, 30, 40 years ago, the late Clayton Shank, Alan Roth, who should be here, and my father. Other than that, there were not a lot of us. There were not a lot. When my family moved into the city, there were a few. But there were not a lot, and that has changed. So I have lots of opinions on this. I just finished up 6 weeks at SMBI on the subject, so I want to consolidate it into 45 minutes this afternoon. But the cities need us. And without getting into the history of the white flight that took place in the after World War II and the devastation that that caused to the cities, so many of the jobs pulled out and just the devastation that happened to the cities that a lot of us, you know, don't spend a lot of time researching, but the cities really need us. Cities are poor. It's where the immigrants are. It's where the disenfranchised, it's the marginalized, it's the people that are looking for safety. The Old Testament model of Christianity might have been come out of the city or come out, yeah, separate, be separate. But I will not take the time today, but I will assure you the New Testament model, the gospel was city. And it was an urban gospel. And in fact, I'm going to say it even though it's not in my notes, but you look at the word, now what is it? Is it that pagan? The word pagan and really means like that it was almost like a heath dweller, almost like a city person. It's really interesting, the root word of pagan, because they were the ones that were out there. And the gospel was so city. Now, I'm not going to read Acts 11 because he stole half my thunder this morning, but I was going to Acts 11, so I'm not going to read it 19 to 26, but the reason the gospel went to Antioch. Now, as he said a lot of the things, I don't know whose notes he was reading, but, you know, it was 300 miles north of Jerusalem in modern-day Turkey. The gospel went there. It went to the Gentiles. There were those 18 districts where you had, you know, the Chinese and all the different groups living, and they were living, I mean, read about Antioch. It was a terrible place. It was poor. There were fights. Those people didn't get along. And all of a sudden, the gospel came, and they didn't know what to call these people because they all started interacting together, and they're like, oh, we'll call them Christians. And Antioch is the cradle of Christianity. But the thing that I'm glad he didn't say, because my best point from that is, Ryan, show us a picture of East Reading, all right? You got a picture there, East Reading, all right. East Reading, and that's the neck of the woods that I work in. And I'm telling you, I go in this triangle all day. I'm devastated I had to drive out here and use gas, you know, because my gas tanks last me like 3 weeks, you know? So I'm just like in this triangle all day, bump, 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 bump. And I just work right in that community all the time. And you look at that, and I think of dense, 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 dense. People, people, people. We're on top of each other. Everything you do, you know, you jackhammer something. We knocked down a wall to garage recently. You're so worried about the neighbors. I mean, you shovel snow. You just got to be so. We live on top of each other. And I look at this, and I look at East Reading, and I tell my and I know that there are about 24 people per acre in East Reading. That's really, really, that is a lot of people. Sugar Creek, Ohio, beautiful place. When I go to Sugar Creek, Ohio, I think I'm in heaven. I mean, it's just, I take like tractor rides and everybody's waving at you. They wave a different way in Reading when you're doing that. But I mean, it just, I feel like I'm in heaven. One person per acre. Boston, I've been to Boston recently. I was up at Sattler College, and I was there. And, you know, it's 11 people per acre. You know, that's kind of, yeah, it's kind of some people there. East Reading, 24 people per acre. And we are on top of each other, okay? We're on top of each other. Now I'm 10 feet from somebody, so I feel like I got lots of room. New York City is, I think, about 28 people per acre. Manhattan, quite a bit more. Maybe, I don't know, 75, 100 people per acre. Antioch people per acre. And it's hard to know for sure. Scholars think maybe 500,000 people. But anywhere from 150 to 200 people per acre. In Antioch, they were just smashed on top of each other. So this is 24 people per acre. That was You know, we're talking 4, 5, 6, 7 times that dense. And so the gospel went where it was dense. And you look at Matthew and Mark, and Jesus said, he went to every town and every village. And when you look, the gospel in the first, 30 years, the 7 of the 8 largest cities had the gospel within just a few years, which was Rome, Alexandria, Ephesus, Antioch, Pergamum, Sardis, and Corinth. And so 7 of the 8 largest cities had churches within the first 30 years of Christ. So when you take the time, and there are so many really good books out there about just urban work, Tim Keller and just a lot of other guys have written. Don't agree with them on near everything, but we can learn a lot about city. And the gospel was very, very urban. We tend to overlook it. Now, our story, our Leg of Mennonites, as I said, went to Reading about 100 years ago. And our story, personal story at Fairview, goes back to 1932, as I showed you earlier. And I love the story of the Mennonites in Reading. I love all Mennonite history, but the story of the Mennonites in Reading is especially intriguing to me. And I think it's so cool that this is our 100th anniversary this year, but I think only myself and 3 other people know it. I mean, nobody cares. You know, it's just like 1922 is really when we kind of, when it all started. But yeah, there's that. But it's just kind of neat, some of the things that took place there. But why they came to Reading, Ryan, you got a picture up for me? The Reading market is infamous. And it's a shame because in 2005, a squatter burned it down. I mean, this is where all the Mennonites came to. This would be about maybe a mile from our house, 6th and Bigamon. My mom would have stood market there, and all the Mennonites would have come and had markets there. And that was the Mennonite witness in Reading. And there were a number of families who said, well, we're bringing our produce and we're bringing our meat and we're bringing everything to Reading. Shouldn't we be bringing our gospel to Reading? And I think it's fascinating how, Ryan, show the next guy. There's Mr. Gaiman up there. Jacob Gaiman was the first superintendent of the Mennonite mission in Reading. And that was in the 1920s. And he was one of, there were basically 4 families that said, okay, you know what? They would have been from Game and Mennonite Church right near like where Nelson and Dorita live and maybe from Bowmansville. And those 4 families took it upon themselves and said, okay, it's not enough that we're going to do produce, but we are going to bring the gospel. And so they started the Witness in Reading in the 1920s. And I say, it's really, to me, it's an incredible story of how many thousands and thousands of people heard the gospel because of those 4 families. And they took the plunge, and they went into Reading, and for the first 10 years or so, it was a Sunday school, and then they started probably the first church in the late 20s, and then we started a couple of years later in the early 30s. But really, it took a lot of guts for those 4 families. Our church would have one of those descendants still in our church. Her parents, now Orpha Gaiman now is getting close to 80, so her father, who I would have known when I was young, but he was one of those that initially went to Reading and said, we are going to plant the church. So I say, you know, we need more of that. And because I'll get to it a little later, the people are in the cities. And it's just a good, good place to go. Next picture up there shows a quick of my family who came to Reading. That was my parents when they moved to Reading for the first time in 1967. So my personal story goes back not quite that long. This was when I'm the little guy on there, and then this is our family a few years ago. But so my parents decided to make the plunge to Reading in 1967. My dad had done 1W service in Washington, D.C., which some of you know, and 1W would have been during the Vietnam War when the Mennonite men did alternate service, and the W actually means the wrong service, But that's kind of the way the government looked at it. But we caught one W service. So he spent 2 years in Washington, D.C., and he was coming home from Washington, D.C., didn't quite know what to do. But the Lord led him to Reading, and that is kind of where we got there. Go ahead, Ryan, show the next picture. That's my family, and I will say I decided to follow that up and stay in Reading, and I can, and I just say that I had, would you say the advantage or the disadvantage, but I experienced the whole gamut in urban. And people have a lot of questions about that, and that's probably the question I get asked the most. But for me, now I'm second generation, it's just so me. 99% of the time, I love the city. It's not hard to raise my family there. My children love to be there. And so it feels like it is very much me. But, you know, as I said, it's not for all, and it's not always easy. And some of you that have done it, especially in some bigger cities, know the sacrifices that it takes. But I say how you know, it was a whole lot harder for the generations past, I think, that they were some of the pioneers that broke through. And I think I have an advantage today because having experienced it as a child. And I look back at my growing up experiences in the city and that, and my dad was, you know, he took free parenting to an extreme. Like, I mean, I grew up on the streets. I played basketball every night at the park. We ran the streets, really. And honestly, we never got in trouble. Arlen's father-in-law got in more trouble than I did. But we didn't really get in trouble. We knew the guys. We played basketball with them. But as I tell people all the time, The way of the city was, for us, was never a threat. It was never like we were like going to get involved in drugs and some of that stuff. It just didn't appeal to us at all. And I think I can say the same thing for my family. I'd quickly say my boys were much quicker to get in trouble with the Mennonite boys from Lancaster County than the boys from the city. Not even close. My dad, that was always my dad's thing, and I found it to be very true that, you know, I never really feared too much my boys. But my sons did grow up much differently than I did, and they probably ran the streets a lot less than I did. Maybe that was because it was a generation ago. I parented a little bit different and did more with my boys as opposed to my dad's generation. But as I say all of the time, that the hardest part of urban, I think, is keeping boys busy. And I hear that over and over. Now, I have two sons. My one son here, Ryan, is disabled. So he didn't face some of those same challenges of what do I do. And then I have one son who is now a freshman in the local college. And so I really only had one that son that was healthy, that what is he going to do? And it just seemed like with him, we found plenty to do. But that's, when people ask me, I always say, by far, that's the biggest challenge. What do you do with your boys? There's no farm. There's not a lot of working things to do. So that definitely is a challenge. Urban work can be discouraging. And I don't want to give the impression that it's just great. Because like everything, it can be hard. It can be hard, as Rod talked about earlier. All right, this is one I think I threw in and I kind of missed. Let me talk about that. I was talking about standing on the shoulders of greatness. And we've been blessed. We've been so blessed at our church, and I say blessed beyond blessed. Luke Horst is the one on the right here. He was really the first, I would say, full-time pastor. And he served Reading for many, many years, and he passed away at almost 100 just a few years ago. And up till 2 years ago, I could say something that was sort of you can't say it a lot, but I said, we have 5 pastors in the history of our church, and they're all living. And that changed about 2 years ago because Luke passed away. He was almost 100. He was ordained in 1941 or so. And before that, it was just kind of like a Sunday school as opposed to a full-fledged church. And Nelson's father, Leroy, served as pastor there for many years. And so I give Luke a lot of credit. You know, Luke is the one that kneeling down there. And I always I'd love to show this picture in my presentation about city life. And this picture, I always say, I'm tired of hearing you people say we Mennonite pastors don't change. And you guys don't change at all. And blah, 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 blah. I'm like, look at that. Does it look like we change? I think it does. Okay? I think it does. Okay? We change. We're just 30, 40 years behind everybody else. Okay? But we tend to change, and that doesn't look like the young people in my church today. But I show that to show Brother Luke there on the left. And, you know, I was the little boy when I was running the streets of East Reading when I was 10. The old ladies would always yell at me, I'm going to tell Brother Luke on you, bud. And I'd respond, yeah, good luck finding him. But Luke was a pillar in East Reading, and he left a real mark, and he moved his family into the city. Didn't go quite as well as my father's, but I have a tremendous amount of respect for Luke and the groundwork that he laid there in the churches of Reading beginning in the early 1940s. The next picture, speaking of urban work, and you know, sometimes it can be discouraging. We get a lot of, I've had, you know, every crime committed against me except murder. But, you know what, some days it's frustrating. You know, we don't always react the right way. But, you know, that's part of it. And this was vandalism a year or two ago. And, you know, yeah, I'm just not going to tell stories. But that's a part of it. That's a part of it. And some days I get frustrated. The one problem I have is people running into my cars. I live on a street that's a nice street for Reading, but cars fly up through there and I just get them hit way too often. And it's frustrating because they will never stop, of course. And I had a funny one on Sunday. I come home from church and it's a decent car. 2000 for me, it's nice. 2011, and it's a decent car, and it was dented in the back. Oh, I was frustrated. I just couldn't believe it. Owned it for a few months, hit again. I'm like, unbelievable. I was just crying the blues. Got over from church Sunday morning, walked in the house, and we're just bemoaning. And then my son's laying on the couch there then, and he hears us talk, and he's like, oh, yeah, I just got a text from my girlfriend. Her dad ran into our car yesterday, and I'm just like praising God. I'm just praising God because I know he'll pay for it. But you know what? Things like that. You know, so I'm going to get my car fixed. But, you know, you name it, vandalism, you know, just a lot of things happen. And I'm not here to tell stories, but that can be frustrating. Yeah, it can be so frustrating. I do a lot of walking and just, you know, the marijuana in Reading now is just like, I mean, you smell it everywhere. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, it's just like everywhere. We had an incident this week at our crossover ministry where, yeah, we had police out. We had guns out. We had Kevin's future son-in-law had a laser over his chest. So, you know, you have those things. And so it can be discouraging, but you know what? It's all good. We just say it's another day. And as I always tell myself, that's why we're here. When I get so mad at the stuff done to me, I say, that's why I'm here. Okay? That's why we're here, because we're here to show the people there's a better way to live. Next picture is just, that was a picture of crossover. We were hanging out there. This picture I like to show and just tell a story. And I have the advantage of just having a lot of perspective, just because I've been there a long time, and before that was my dad. And I like to read history, so I get into the history of the work and that. And this lady in the middle, her name is Helen Hotchkins. And I would have known Helen Hotchkins. I'm guessing she died in the early 80s. But I put that picture up there to tell a story of just the importance, really, of trying to find a way to get men saved. And, you know, we've probably a lot of you have heard that stat. And I believe stats about half the time. But I don't know how, but if this stat, there's probably some truth to it. But it says if a man gets saved first in a family, I think there's like a 92% chance the whole family will be saved. If it's a mother, I think it's like, what, 17 or something. And if it's a child, it's 4%. So we really, you know, we want to get the hearts of the fathers, but that's hard. That's hard. And I think of this family here. This family here, Helen Hotchkins in the middle, nearly 100 years ago. I think it might have been about 1930. 1930, she lived where I grew up on the street. I played in the house where this was. When I played in it, it had electricity. But when the Mennonites knocked on her door in, I think, about 1930, she was holding a little girl on her hip named Ethel Kurtz. And Ethel Kurtz is in her 90s and still living right there in the community. We see her quite often and minister to her. But the Mennonites, I think it was Christmas time, and they were handing out Christmas baskets, and they ministered to this Helen Hotchkins. And she became a believer. Should have put a, but just a really, really neat story of how Helen came to faith. And the point of this is we've had five generations of this family that has gone through our church. Not one man ever got saved. And and you can see kind of the effect it's had. Helen's husband, Carl, never became a Christian. He allowed her to live out her faith, but he never became a Christian. And so they passed on, and Helen's daughter, Ethel, is in her 90s, and they still live there, haven't moved by the church. And Eddie never became a Christian. And her husband, Eddie's not a Christian. Ethel faithfully served the Lord. That she did. And Ethel can't come to church anymore due to health reasons, but she was really a member at our church for, I don't know, 40, 50 years. But Ethel went through our church. Ethel had a daughter named Debbie. And Debbie was her daughter, and Debbie went through our church as a child, as a teenager. And then when she hit, 18, 19 or whatever, boom, at the door. And I just had a funeral probably this past fall for her husband. It would be her husband, Jim, who never served the Lord. And Debbie had two sons named Matt and Sean. And I grew up with Matt and Sean. And they're in the community, played basketball with them. They were big, heavy metal rockers. And so I spent a lot of time with Matt and Sean, grew up, knew them. They came to church. They came to Bible school. They came to Sunday school. I think the last time Sean was at church, he didn't want to be there anymore. And we had the Sunday school picnic, and it was out in Burnville. And he went out to the Sunday school picnic, and he didn't want to be there. And he walked home from Burnville. He walked home. And that was it. He was done. And Matt, Sean and Matt, they had twin daughters. And they came to Sunday school. They were in our school for a number of years. And then when they hit about, 14, 15, they went on their way. And there were ladies who loved the Lord, but we never got a man. I got some ear. Thanks, Randy. Yeah, thanks. They never got a man committed in that family. There was never a man committed. And I wonder what difference it would have made in this family had it been different. We'll never know. But I'm going to show one more picture here of some of those old saints. And I'm talking generations. Generations. And this picture here is May Naur, Bessie Naur, and Naomi Newell. May Naur, some of you would know as May Good, the late May Good. And May Good would have passed away, I don't know, is it 10, 12 years ago? But May Good was just, she was a city girl. And her parents were not friendly to the gospel at all. And they didn't want to have anything to do with the Mennonites who were coming around with their religion and what they had to offer. But eventually, May on the left, eventually she did. She decided to join the Anabaptist group there in Reading, and the generational changes that took place because of that. A lot of people don't even know that. Everybody in Lancaster County knows Roy Good, the auctioneer. Everybody knows Roy Good, but nobody knows that Roy Good's mother was a city girl and that her parents wanted nothing to do with the Mennonites' gospel. And eventually they warmed up to it, and they, you know, the rest is history. And there we have generations of their family are in our church, and May made the choice to marry Roy Good Sr., who was just a man of God. And so just the difference in those two families of Ethel, who did, and May. And the one on the right, Naomi Newell, I think that's Mary Newell. I think. And I could tell a story about her. Some things just cycle around. It was the 1970s, and there was high gas, high inflation, and I'm pretty sure that's that girl on the right. I'm pretty sure she was the one that drove our family to church. And there's a story about that in this book that I'll talk about a little later. But lots of memories, and these go way back. But the Lord has blessed in so many ways over the years. I think of about maybe 30 years ago, and some people that God brought in. My brother-in-law, and interesting about my family, I'll put this note in there too, that three of my siblings married people from the city / broken homes. And, you know, and they're serving the Lord today. Maybe they face some struggles that maybe I didn't face, but they're all serving the Lord today, and God's been very good. But I think of my brother-in-law, Dwayne, been through a lot. And he came from some tough circumstances, but faithfully serving the Lord today. My other brother-in-law, Kevin, him and I are just as opposite as opposite. He was a city boy there in Reading, and him and I get along well, even when we talk politics. And you know what? We don't see everything eye to eye, but God has used him, and I love him dearly. I think of even going into today, and so the many opportunities that we have today. We have Fairview Christian School, our administrator sitting right here, so I got to behave. He's my boss. But, you know, we have so many opportunities. Ryan sits every day with some boys from Reading and teaches them and tutors with them. My next-door neighbor is from a non-Christian family, and he's off this week with at our school at the ISC, and just a wonderful opportunity and able to just minister into his life. I say that we have learned a lot. We have a lot to learn, and we've learned a lot through failure. And we've been around 100 years, so we've learned a lot. And a lot of times by messing up, like all of us. And the committee asked for some personal examples of, you know, some of the things that we learned and what I would say to young people that are planting. I lived through a transformation in Reading. When I was growing up, Reading was racist. It was white, Polish, Catholic. Our community there, we had the East Reading Swimming Pool, and there were no Spanish people allowed in that pool. There were no black people allowed in that pool. And this is East Reading. I'm going to show a picture in a few minutes of one of my African-American pastors from Reading. And it's interesting that he told me, he's like, yeah, in this community, he said, the only ones that would invite me into their church were the Mennonites, were you guys. And so the community that I grew up in, yeah, I knew. I wasn't allowed to go to the swimming pool for other reasons. And you can imagine what they are, but I knew the Spanish kids and the black kids weren't allowed to go to that pool. No way. And so that was the context that I grew up there in the city. And I feel like I woke up one day and the city had completely changed around me. And today we're about 70% Latino. I don't know, is it 10% black? So the white flight just continues in the inner cities. And so it totally changed on me. Everything around me changed from what it was. And I feel like in some ways we woke up late, and because it changed so gradually. All of a sudden it's like, wow, this community is different. And in some ways it's better, But there was a time when I was a boy, every single person in that community went to our summer Bible school. Everybody. I'm telling you, it was just, they all went to our summer Bible school. Nowadays, you don't have those long-term relationships because the Latino community is so transient. They just move. I was recently on a forum with, here's a surprise, for picking up trash in Reading. And we were trying to figure out how we could beautify the city of Reading. I think that disbanded because they gave up. But I was on with the principal of the local school there in Reading, right at 10th and Penn. And it still blows my mind that she said during the school year, and it was this time of year, that 60% of her kids in the school that year were had switched during the year. I can't imagine. But, yeah, my mind was blown by what she said about that. And maybe that was in it. Maybe that was a that was before COVID. I don't know what's changed. I couldn't believe it. And I wouldn't think it's near that high normally, but it's just moving. So, you know, those deep relationships that we used to have, they're gone. There's a few of those people left, but they're kind of angry. They're mad they're in the city. They hate the city. And so that's one thing that everything just changed around us. And we just kind of like, it changed so gradually, just kind of metamorphed to that. And what can, and so in like in our Spanish, you know, now we realize, okay, we got to learn Spanish. You know, we all learn Spanish in high school like you do, you know what? But we don't have the grasp of it like we need. And now we got to readdress that. But I know in truth, which no excuse, but we spend so much time with children and they're all bilingual. But we have to do better job with the adults because it's just a new world and that's so recent. But the great part about being there for all this time, though, is we just lock down that community all the time with cars or events or parties or whatever. And nobody cares because we were there first. It's almost like our community. So that's what's nice. Community loves us. They're never mad at us because they know we were there before them. And so we're just a part of it. I wouldn't want to come in and do some of the things we do now. If we weren't there first, but that is one of the things that, that we learned. It changed around us so gradually and so rapidly. And so we woke up one day, what do we do now? One of the neat things that we get to do is partner with others. And we do that, you know, I really enjoy that aspect, partnering with other groups. Right now we have a group meeting in our church. In our gym. Mr. King's a big part of helping them. But they came in over COVID and they got kicked out of the public school. So they moved into our gym and they're doing church there and we're able to do some things with them. But the thing that I think is really neat, you know, you can touch a community in so many different ways. And I was chatting because some of their families come to our school. We play baseball with them. We've become good friends with a number of the families there at Christ Community Church. I was talking to one of the guys the other day, and it was a real, it inspired me that he said, you know what, we're here because you guys are here. And I'm like, that's really, really, I never thought about that. I never, you know, you don't always see what you're doing. But he said, you know, you guys moved into Reading, and you guys showed us it can be done. And so they moved their church into Reading, and they had a bunch of people leave because of it. And, you know, they're excited to be there, and they're our neighbors now, and we're able to just support each other. And it's just kind of a side thing that I really enjoyed is partnering with some of them and helping them. Lessons we've learned, I will tell you that the last 2 years have been difficult. They've been brutal in some ways. And, you know, we are all, I'll simply say, we're all products of our environment. And we all sit in different seats. And you're going to see the world from the seat that you live in. And I was called names the last 2 years that I thought I'd never be called. Woke, Democrat, left-wing, liberal, and a bunch of other things like that. And I'm like, where did that come from? But I will just say, for those of us that were in the city the last 2 years, we felt like this. We were like, it was like this. We were in the crosshairs of the city and the Anabaptist community. And you know what? I'm still struggling. with, you know, getting past that and just some of the things where, you know, I was, you know, my core values were just sort of serve the community and serve the people. And it was hard. That aspect was just like brutal. Okay. And it was because of our location and because who we're trying to minister to. And, you know, I've always personally been against church mission statements. You know, I'm always like, no, we got the Great Commission. We don't need a mission statement. We don't need a mission statement. And I'm rethinking that. And I'm realizing now that maybe I didn't do a good enough job of just casting my vision to everybody and the vision and the heartbeat. You know, I felt like I was the Apostle Paul, like in, you know, 1 Corinthians, and that's kind of where I'm at. My word, I'll wear 3 masks when I'm with this group, and I'll wear 4 masks with this group, and I won't wear my mask with this group. And, I mean, I'll just do anything. I don't even care. To me, it was like brown or white socks, you know. So it just didn't matter. And, you know, was it that way everywhere? But that's what the city was, you know. And the Latino people were so chill about it, too. You know, they were really chill, you know. You know, it was a wake-up call for me. Because I tend to say, and you can disagree with me, but I tend to say when we go overseas, we're really quick to adapt the culture. But in our own, we feel like we have ownership. And so it's like, no, not here. And so it troubled me because it's like, I don't want you to offend the people I'm trying to reach. And so that was something I'm still processing. I'm still trying to figure out how we can do this better, how we have our strong opinions as Anabaptists in our culture, and as we interact with these groups that have a culture that is different, I'll simply say, I think we could have done a better job. I think we could have done a better job. And so that's one thing that I've learned. I felt like we weren't clear enough for our churches why we're in the city. And you know what? Like I said, I kind of like the city, but you know what? I'm in there for a reason. And some days it's just I get frustrated with this stuff. You know, really can't have anything nice. Everything gets vandalized. Everything gets run into. And so maybe I haven't done a good enough job of casting the vision of why we are there. So I've learned that. I think, and I feel, third thing I'm just thinking about of what I would say is anybody that knows me, ask Mr. King afterwards, but I'm an Anabaptist of Anabaptists, okay? I teach Anabaptist history. I think the Anabaptist way, the kingdom way Jesus teaching is the best way. And I just feel we have something. I think it's a tragedy that we're just throwing it out. Some of our people just throwing out the way of the cross and so I think we have something, and I believe in it so much that I don't mind interacting with other people. I really don't, and I think our church we've done that, and I don't regret that at all. Teaming up with other groups and helping them—that we will do. And one of the things that I got to do recently, I stay right there for a minute. This was my point that I forgot to tell him to flip earlier. I'm like, this is our summer Bible school. You know, that was my daughter, my sister, who's not living anymore on the right. So if she's 16 there, 80, mid-80s. And I'm like, wow. So this was mid-80s. You can see one thing. We're all Caucasian up there. And that just was making my point how much we changed. The next one is the opportunities we have to work with people. And part of my, you know, I love building bridges with people. And I think I've had the opportunity personally almost to work more with the African-American community just because the things that were going on in the last 2 years. I have a lot of Latino friends, too. But I had the opportunity to reach into the life of some African-American pastors, and just such a blessing. And to see the world from their perspective and how different it is. The one on the right, he's a very, Dr. Bruce Alec, pastors of church just there in Reading. And I think he's spent time with either Martin Luther King Jr. or his wife. He's a big shot. He's great. Does a lot of good. And the one on the left was Pastor Jerry Jones. Him and I are friends. And we do a lunch or two together every year, getting ready to do another one with him. And he's the one that grew up in East Reading. and said how the Mennonites were the only ones that reached out to him, but just hearing their heart. And I say a lot of times where we as Anabaptists haven't done good in some of these realms is because we don't have any friends outside of our circles. All the people that we work with, and unless we really learn, get alongside of them, live with them, rub shoulders with them, we're never going to understand them. Of all the things that we did, and all the mistakes that we made, and all the things we did right, I will say over and over again, the thing that my father did right was he was naive. My dad was naive. And if you know my dad, you can understand that. He's my hero. But my dad just had all the energy and inspiration. I say my dad couldn't administrate. He couldn't run the ice cream shop on the third floor at lunchtime. He can't run anything, okay? My dad couldn't administrate it, but he did administrate our school. But that's not his gift. But he can start everything. He's the I like you. He's just I inspiring, but I'm sure you're a great administrator. But my dad just liked to start things. And I always had the job of coming behind and, like, trying to run it. And he was always off to the next thing. So, but that was my pop. But meeting the needs, we got to move on. All right. We're there to meet needs. What can we do better? We're running out of time here. So let me quick. I want to hit a few important things here before we close. Opportunities. I'm just going to bet you in the next session, whoever speaking is going to talk about this book. Anybody know what this book is? Gary Miller's Reaching America. If you haven't read this book, read it. You got to read this book, you know, ways that, and things we need to do better. Reaching America by Gary Miller. And the one big thing he talks about is the home. Using our homes. So if you haven't read that book, read it. I also brought along my mom's book. And I have a handful here. And they're free. I might have a couple more back here. I got to just bless my parents. My parents were giving people. I lived in an open house. My dad was crazy. And there's some of the stories in this book. You know, I'm surprised we're alive. Because he let anybody in our house at any time. And, but, you know, I just give... I give a ton of credit to my parents. And so if you want one of these books, please, they're free. Take one along. I got a few here. And Called of God is the story of the Church of Reading while I'm showing books here and that. And you can find that on the internet. It's all about the churches of Reading. So take a peek at that. But things haven't gotten any easier reaching people. And, you know, we spend a lot of time... Why? You know, I wish I could stand here and say, people are breaking the doors down to get in my church. I wish I could say that. I will admit that sometimes churches felt like a revolving door and kind of what Rod talked about. And, you know, but yet I don't consider any of them losses. Nothing is a loss. And if Alan Roth was here, he'd be saying that. I think I learned that from him. But, you know, we've had so many people come through. So many people come through. And I could tell story after story after story. And I wish more of them would have stayed. And I wish, but we do. We have lots of stories of good. Lots of people have stayed and generational people that have stayed. Do I think it is getting harder in some ways? Yes. I found it interesting that C.S. Lewis said this. Now, this was a number of years ago, but he talked about, obviously, a number of years ago. But, you know, we read the revivals in Jesus' time, Pentecost, and when so many were just being saved and the Holy Spirit was coming down. And he made the case that the early church, that it was... And I don't want to make excuse for us, but there was a different feeling back then. There was something different. The people were God-fearers. The people believed in absolutes. They believed in life after death. They were believed in the supernatural world. They believed in judgment. There was a belief system at the time of the early church that that is not existent today. And that's no excuse for us. Mark 4 is Jesus, I say manifesto in evangelism, the parable of the soil. Okay? We always call it the parable of the sower, but I don't buy that too much. It's the parable of the soil. The soil was different. And I think that's important for us to remember too, is that what made the difference was the soil. And what made the difference is what happened to that soil before the seed hit it. I think Gary covers that in this book, but that's not where I got my thoughts from. And he added a fourth soil. There's a lot of contaminated soil today. And I think that's in the truest sense. There is a lot of contaminated soil. But that is very true. And I often say that I am, you know, I'm really big in working together. And I'm a soil preparer. You know, they might not take the gospel from me. But I think, again, it was Alan that says, is it maybe they need to hear the gospel the eighth time? I say, we're not going to lead everybody to the cross every time. But we prepare soil. And the results, we don't have to get the results. Isn't that the good part? What we're supposed to do every time is represent Jesus in every situation. That's our highest call. Make disciples. Not make disciples of you. It's make disciples of Jesus. And so it's never a loss if we've represented Christ right. Every situation, we just represent Christ right. We try to represent Him right. Represent Him right. And that is a win every time. And so I say we're quick to work with other people. And that's kind of, yes, let's talk about this one. I'm running out of time here. I'm skipping over my notes. But Reading gives you some, City just gives you, as I say, more bang for your buck. We love to work with hurting people. And, you know, our church is just a magnet for it. We love it. And these are some, I just love the picture on the right. This is a typical Sunday morning. That's all Jason and I's family around us. And don't they all look mad? They're just embarrassed that the two preachers are back there just having a great time with one of our favorite friends from the city. And, I give him about five fist bumps every Sunday morning between about 10:50 and 11:10. This is what we do. There at the bottom, some of you have Turkey. Everybody knows Turkey, whether you go to Fairview or not. And up on the right there is one of my other friends. But the city, just so many hurting people. And in those hurting people, I want to say this in the last 5 minutes. Be all in if you go to the city. Be all in. Because the hurting people there need you. Ryan, show the last one of Iron Park. Just another opportunity. And you can do this anywhere. But the city just gives you so many opportunities. Tim Keller says this. Summer commuters. They go to the city to get something done. Then they're going to move out. Then they're survivors. They're there because they have to be. I know a lot of those. I know a lot of people in the city. They hate the city. Oh, they just want to talk bad about the city. I know a lot of them. The next group is the consumers. They say they love the city, but they mainly love the experience of the city. And then there are the natives. I sort of consider myself a native. They're the ones that are there. They love the city. They feel a part of it. And most importantly, they want to make it better. If you go to the city, the community needs you. And you can make the community better. I hear it all the time, how we make the community better. And so be a native, be of the city. Some churches are just in the city. We don't want to be a church that's just in the city. That doesn't work. There's a lot of churches that are really against the city. You know, not against it in a way, and Arrow's benefited from that. And they got that church there, and so many churches like that in Reading. They're not against the city, but it's not working anymore. It's just not working anymore. And then there's churches that are of the city. Some churches of the city. You don't want to be a church of the city. I said we're having fun this summer with Lighthouse or Christ Community Church, and then we're playing a little softball with them. And the other night I was there with my kid, and the commissioner of the league gave him a speech, and he's like, "You can't, and in this league, there can't be any weed smoking after the game." And we're like, "Hey, this is a church softball team." And he said, "I had to say it to our team. It's not our team." But so, the church softball league, they're smoking weed after the game at the park. What's wrong with this picture? So, we're not to be. We're not to be churches of the city, but we want to be churches for the city. Make your church, I really believe, I would like to believe, that the city would miss us if we move. I think they'd miss all the trash I pick up. Right, Mr. King? I mean, that they would miss. I'd like to believe they'd miss some other things too. But we want to be a church that is for the city, that the city will miss us if we're not there. A lot of times, people struggle with cities. I'm not a nature guy, okay? I'm not a nature guy. Like, the heavens declare the glory of God, I know it, but I've never seen the Rockies. My co-pastor loves produce and farms and sunsets and rivers, and I'm okay with cement macadam, okay? I'm okay with that. And I think it was Finney Curavilla who says this, and probably many others too, but I heard him say it, that we need to see. What are we at? Where do we find the image of God? We need to see it on people's faces in the cities, because that's really where it's at. And we always see the beauty. We always talk about the beauty of God out there, but we've got to see it on people's faces. The city's not for everybody. Again, Nelson's father pastored there for many years, did a good job, but that city blood never got Nelson's father like it gotten my father. One of my co-pastors, we all but ran him out of the city. "Ted, you don't belong here. Go produce farm. I'd rather go to do anything than produce farm." But, you know, he's so happy to do that. And we're so happy to have him out there. But so it's not for everybody. Summit really, and I co-pastor now with Nelson's brother, and he's much more farm than I am. But it's not for everybody. But it's where the people are. And we know the cities are just growing and growing and growing. You look at the percent. How many people are moving? And I don't know what COVID's going to do with that, but the cities, the people are going to the cities as we're all just, all the Christian influence is just leaving. What kind of sense does that make? That as millions move to the city, this is pre-COVID, now I don't know what exactly how it's going to shake out, but all, many Christians, many Anabaptists are just, let's get out. And it's like, well, I don't know. I mean, the Great Commission was sort of be around people. So it's kind of like God's big deal. So it's not for everybody, but as Anabaptists, let's just not like be against it. And sometimes I just want to hold my ears when I hear my kids talk in school, the things they say about the city. It's not your kids, Kevin, don't worry. But some of the harsh things they say about the city, but we need to see the image of God on people. People are moving to the cities. But don't feel bad if it's not you. Please don't feel bad. And you know, I've seen a lot of people come to the city and they flame out. They came up with all the excitement. Man, they came to the city and, man, they were going to be it. They were almost going to make me look bad that I don't do enough. But you know what? After 5-6 years, it's almost like, why am I here? I'm just working like crazy. I'm just like everybody else. Our way of doing things was just move in there and just live in life. And I think it's the most effective thing we did. We just live life. We have the same stresses as the people. And they see us work and they see us cut our grass and they see us laugh and they see us cry. Believe me, first they think you're a little nuts. I'm telling you. They think you're extra chromosome. They are weird people. But I'm telling you, once they see the struggles you have and once they see you live, we're usually the most popular people in the street, as I know you guys are. In fact, I just had a neighbor talk to me this morning. He's going away for a week, and he wants me to watch his house, give me the keys to his house, the keys to his car. You know what? Just a thing that my dad set the example and said, we're going to go to the city, and we're just going to live life there, was just, you know, I look back and say it took a lot of guts, but it was just a blessing. So, you know what? I've been blessed. I've been blessed. I love what I do most days. And whatever God has called you to do, do it. And maybe you're that person that's going to be the Jacob Gaiman we looked at, or you're going to be the Abram Gaiman or his father, or the Goods. And there are all these people that I know, their grandchildren. But they took the plunge, and thousands heard the gospel. And that really, really blesses and encourages me. So I would ask for, we could discuss, but it's time to close. And I don't really have the answers to your questions anyway. I'm all about learning. So, hey, we'll pray and we'll be dismissed. All right. Thank you, Father, for this opportunity. And Lord, the cities are full of hurting people, and hurting people can frustrate us sometimes, but that's why we go. And if there's people here that are thinking about going, I pray that you would just show them if it's for them. Lord, it's not for all, but if it's for them, just give them the courage to make the decision. And thank you for those that have gone on before, like Alan Roth, like my father, the late Clayton Shank, and others who were willing to show us it can be done and help us to have the courage to remain as it gets tougher sometimes. Thank you for all your blessings. In Jesus' name, amen.